The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network. This week's episode of The Writer Files is brought to you by New Media Dojo and our podcast production partners. I want to highlight our work with bestselling author Jeff Goines on his great new show, Hey Creator. Join Jeff, his co-hosts, including myself, and guests for a weekly mixtape about the creator economy. Hey Creator, a mixtape for the creative class, is a publication, podcast, and soon-to-be community for people who are tired of boring and ready for interesting. Learn more at heycreator.me and find Hey Creator wherever you tune into podcasts. I've got a clip from that show at the break. Make a sound impression with New Media Dojo and inquire today about all your podcast production needs. Just head over to newmediadojo.com to talk podcast. That's newmediadojo.com.
In this book, like in the others, I'm still dealing with the same obsession. Motherhood, desire, sexuality, violence, structure of domination. I think that many writers would say that, but we are always obsessed with the same thing, and we can spend a whole lifetime trying to explore the same theme and the same obsession.
Greetings, scribes, and welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you wisdom, words, and wherewithal per usual. Award-winning writer and journalist Layla Slimani spoke to me about the challenges of writing historical fiction, imposter syndrome, and what it's like to live in the country of others. Layla is the French-Moroccan author of the award-winning, number one internationally best-selling novel, The Perfect Nanny, New York Times Book Review, 10 Best Books of the Year 2018, for which she became the first Moroccan woman to win France's most prestigious literary prize, the Goncourt. Her latest novel, In the Country of Others, first in a planned trilogy about how women's lives change over three generations, was named a best book of the summer by Vogue, eWeekly, BuzzFeed, Philadelphia Inquirer, Town & Country, Observer, Millions, and many more. Salman Rushdie said of the book, "The world of this novel, Morocco after World War II, leading up to the revolt against French colonialism, is beautifully created, an exceptional, powerful novel from the justly celebrated writer." Layla is also an award-winning journalist, an outspoken commentator on women's and human rights, and a diplomat to French President Emmanuel Macron for the promotion of the French language and culture. In this file, Layla and I discussed giving voice to the voiceless and time traveling in your work, racial inequality and the global taboos surrounding a history of colonization, the importance of coffee and cigarettes to the creative process, a writer's guilt, the perils of success, and why writers just need a good glass of French red wine. Stay calm and write on. If you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published. And please drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to help other writers find us. All right, welcome back to The Writer Files. I am honored today to be joined by the illustrious, award-winning author, Layla Slimani, is joining us. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. How are you surviving? I'm assuming that you're overseas still, or are you doing a tour here in the United States?
No, actually, I'm in Morocco. I'm talking to you from very far away, but yes, I have a lot of media in the US and in the Great Britain, but that's great. So I'm half in Morocco and half with you.
Very cool. Yeah, so how are things feeling or looking in Morocco right now? Because, the world's kind of been a little bit on edge during this pandemic, but things have gotten better and worse in certain places.
Yeah, it's difficult. I have to say that the government did a lot of things in terms of vaccination for the Moroccan people. So it's going faster and faster in terms of vaccination, but still we have a lot of cases here. And so we still have curfew and a kind of lockdown. So life is very difficult for a lot of people, and especially people working in the tourism. And now that we can't welcome tourists, it's difficult for them to make a living without tourism.
Yeah, as we often discuss, the concentric circles of crises never seem to cease. But yeah, we could talk about that. But I want to talk about your writing and this fantastic first piece of a trilogy that you've just given birth to. But yeah, how are you feeling about going into this promotion and about the book in general and all of the fantastic praise?
Oh, you know, I'm feeling very good because it's always very interesting to promote a book in another language and in another culture. In the reaction in France and in the US are very different. And I have to say that in the United States, you may be more accustomed to postcolonial studies, to the questions of race, and this kind of conversation are maybe easier in your country than in France. In France, a lot of people don't really want to talk about colonization. So, yeah, I find it very interesting to have the point of view of American commentators.
Yeah, definitely. I thought, well, Salman Rushdie, obviously, a celebrated author in his own right, has something very nice to say about the work. He called it an exceptional, powerful novel from a justly celebrated writer. And yeah, so talk about tackling this kind of the bigger subjects around in the country of others and, you know, coming off the Goncourt and kind of your feelings about, you know, the themes behind this novel and the genesis of that.
The genesis of the project of writing a trilogy comes from the fact that after the Goncourt and after the success of The Perfect Nanny, I did a big tour, and everywhere people were asking me, journalists or readers, about my identity. And it was always very difficult for me to answer because sometimes I was saying I was French, sometimes I was saying I was Moroccan. People were asking me about religion, about my values, what I was believing in. And I was always very frustrated by my answers. And at the end, I decided that maybe the best way to answer people about who I am was to write about that and to write a book about my family, where I come from, why my life, my identity, who I am, the way I write is so much influenced by the couple of my grandparents, by colonization, and by the whole story of Morocco and the relationship between France and Morocco. So I think that's the genesis of the project. But of course, in this book, like in the others, I'm still dealing with the same obsession: motherhood, desire, sexuality, violence, structure of domination. You know, I think that many writers would say that, but we are always obsessed with the same thing, and we can spend a whole lifetime trying to explore the same theme and the same obsession.
Well, it is something to behold, and congratulations on the work. I found it interesting that you described some part of that genesis of writing about, you know, this semi-autobiographical historical fiction that, you know, kind of starts out in the late 40s, early 50s Morocco, but that you mentioned that you kind of had always felt like your grandparents were characters in a movie, right? Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that and then, you know, how this story diverges or is maybe not divergent in their characterization.
You know, as a child, when I was spending a lot of time with my grandparents, and I was fascinated by them. And especially by my grandmother, because she was a great storyteller, and every day she would tell us stories that she invented, but also stories about her life, her childhood, and how she met my grandmother, my grandfather, and the war, and all that. I'm pretty sure that she told me a lot of lies, because she wanted me to be quiet, and she wanted me to go to sleep, so she told me what I wanted to hear. But as a child, it worked, and I was fascinated by that. And also, she was very tall. She was blonde with green eyes. She would live in the countryside. She would speak perfect Arabic. So for me, she was so different from the other grandmothers that I knew. And she was, as you said, the character of a movie. She was not real. She was not only my grandmother. She was a character. And I think that when I began to write the book, I never asked myself, is what I'm telling, is it true? Did it really happen? But what I wanted is to feel again the feeling that I had as a child, this feeling of fascination and this emotion hearing the stories of my grandmother.
Yeah. What do you feel personally is the most challenging piece of historical fiction as opposed to, you know, say writing nonfiction? But, you know, as a journalist, there are different pieces that you probably, parts of your creativity you engage that are a little bit different than this type of writing. Can you talk a little bit about maybe the differences for you personally?
Yeah, I think that what is the most difficult when you write a historical novel is not to write with the point of view of someone who lives in 2021. I really wanted to capture the point of view of my characters in the present of their life. If you write today about colonization with the distance and the information that we have today, of course, you're going to be in a kind of judgment because you know how it ends and you know who were the good guys and the bad guys, if you want to say. So I really wanted to try capture the point of view of Mathilde and Amin. They don't really understand what's happening around them. They are very confused. Everything is very ambiguous. And like many people, like the majority of people, like we today, they are more concerned by the farm, by their children, by their day-to-day lives than by the political problems happening in the capital or in the world. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to show that. And I think that's something difficult because when you begin the research, you have a lot of information and you want to put this information in the book, but you have to choose the good information, and you have to really be careful not to write with the point of view of someone who has the distance that I have today.
Yeah, so talk some about the power of the meaning of the title. And, you know, when you're talking about the others in particular, kind of how this theme runs throughout your body of work and your fiction in particular.
No, I think that a lot of people can rely on that or identify to this feeling. When you're a migrant, you completely understand what it is to live in the country of others. The others, the one who rules, the one who dominates, the one who are in their country, who are rooted to the land, and you feel like a stranger. I think that a lot of women also can understand that. The love of people, of poor people, invisible, voiceless people, they live in the country of others. So it's not only a question of race or a question of nationality. It can also be a question of class, a question of gender, this feeling of otherness and this feeling of being an outcast, of not belonging to the group or to the dominant.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and as you said, it's pretty fascinating that, you know, here in the United States, that obviously these are conversations that we're having concerning, you know, racism, racial inequality, and kind of systematized discrimination of, you know, communities of color and the foundation of our country. But you think in particular that this novel, as it's been embraced, kind of been called the best book of the summer by many outlets here, you think this is probably the right time for this novel to kind of deliver this message in particular?
Yes, I think so. You know, the generation of my parents and of my grandparents, they wouldn't speak about that period of time, about colonization, because a lot of people think that this is a taboo in France or in Britain, but this is also a taboo here in the colonized country because people don't want to talk about the time where they were humiliated, where they were a victim of racism. It's very difficult to talk about that. And I think that maybe my generation is the first generation that will be able to explore that and try to understand what the experience was and try also to understand the consequences, the long-lasting consequences of colonization on us. Because I'm always surprised in France when people say, oh, well, we are fed up with colonization. Why do you want to talk about that again? It was a long time ago. But I always answer, it was not a long time ago. It's the childhood of my mother. It's very close to me, very close to us. And we should be able to look at this and to really explore that time. And I think that artists and writer, novelists especially, they can do that because my aim as a writer is not to judge. It's not to make a trial. It's to try to also put some complexity, some nuance, some ambiguity, to have a to look at it with humanity and with a certain tenderness. And that's our goal as writer, to do that.
And I just want to take a quick break to share a clip of best-selling author Jeff Goins and me talking about writer's block on the Hey Creator podcast. You can listen to more on Apple Podcasts or wherever you tune in. How do you beat writer's block, you personally? Do you lean into procrastination? I can't remember.
Is this an episode of The Writer Files? I don't think it's real. I think writer's block is an oversimplified way of talking about bundled emotions. I think writer's block for me is fear of my own inadequacy. It can be inertia. It can be the fact that I just haven't done something for a while. But it's like, how do you beat trauma? You acknowledge it. So I think when I hear people say, you just keep writing. I mean, on one hand, yeah, that's true. On the other hand, I think writer's block is an invitation to acknowledge a deeper truth, which is probably I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm scared.
Oh, well, absolutely.
That makes sense. Versus I have writer's block. It sounds like a disease that you caught. Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly modern invention, the concept of writers not being able to write. Yeah, on one hand, when I have a deadline, I think of writing as a job and I do it. On the other hand, writing is a life-giving experience for me and I do it almost every day, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little. And I give myself a break. I want writing to be a job and also a life-giving experience. And there's times when I sit down because I have to, because I have a deadline, like today. I had to cancel a lunch and now I'm going to work on a book. And then there's times where it's like, you know, Anne Lamott says there's a difference between being blocked and being empty. And one of the best things you can do is go get filled, go for a walk, take a nap, read, eat something, fill yourself up. And when I feel like I felt this morning, which is stressed and anxious, I woke up with 100 answers to questions that I didn't know my body was asking. I woke up feeling anxious. I need to do this. I need to fix this. And our process is broken and we need to do this instead of that. And so I woke up with this anxiety. And I know that when I act from that place, the actions are not good, whole. They don't lead to good places. They create more anxiety because it's frenetic energy. And so I went to lunch or to breakfast, I guess, with a friend and had some coffee and actually our mutual friend, Charlie. And
just thinking about Charlie.
Yeah. And he asked me that question, you know, what do you do with it? Because I told him, here's how I'm feeling. And I was just feeling like shame and fear. And he says, what do you do? I said, I try to move. I move my body. If I ever feel blocked, I get up and start moving. I go for a walk. I did this a lot during the pandemic season one. We're in pandemic season two now, but pandemic season one was, I would walk. And whenever I walk for 30 minutes or so, get out into nature around trees, a little bit. I live around a lot of trees, so it's not hard to do that. I will immediately pull out my phone and start writing something. And it's like that story I told before about, you know, Dylan quits music, quote unquote retires. We've talked about this, right? We told this story where he quits folk music, goes to that house in New York, and doesn't bring a guitar with him.
In Woodstock.
Yeah, in Woodstock. And then ends up writing Like a Rolling Stone. And it's like as soon as you get away from your work, it comes back to you. But in a way that feels lighter. So I think I actually when I'm clear and centered and grounded, I work with writer's block because writer's block is telling me something isn't working. And it could be I'm afraid. It could be I'm stressed. Stress is fear. It could be I'm just feeling anxious about other things. And if that's true, I've got to go move. I've got to go do some things. But for me, forcing myself to write is like re-traumatizing my creative self. Do it anyway, you know? And beautiful things don't come out of obligation for me. But if I can just let go for a minute, oh, I'm feeling blocked. I'm feeling stymied. Go for a walk, put it down, step away from it, say no, just to get some space around. And that space could be 30 minutes or it could be, you know, a few days or a week or a month. And like intentionally invest in something that fills me up, which is like doing anything physical or doing anything restful gets me feeling pretty good. And then I come back to the work refreshed and ready to dig back into it. You know, we can think of writer's block as feeling stuck, but another way of thinking about it is like fasting. It's good for your body to not eat food all the time. That works better for some people than it does for others. But I've enjoyed that because I kind of do feast or famine everything, right? I go from one direction to the other. Light switch goes on or off. There's no in between. But writer's block may actually be an invitation to fast from the work that you were doing in the way that you have been doing it. And I think for me, it's really freeing to step away from that work consciously, intentionally, to trust that when I step back into it, I've got something. Sometimes I hold on too tightly to my own regimen and routine as the only way to do it. And Edison had this method for coming up with ideas where he had a chair that he sat in and he had a little like metal plate at his feet. Do you know the story? Mm-mm. And he would hold like a ball or something. He'd hold a metal object. He'd sit in his chair and he would sink down in his chair when he was feeling blocked, when he could not solve a problem. And he'd sit and he'd fall asleep. And as soon as he'd fall asleep, entering into that dream world, his hands would release the ball. It would drop down, hit the metal plate, and he would wake up. And he would have the answer.
That's cool.
Leonardo da Vinci had, I think, a somewhat similar problem. I mean, he had a process for solving the same problem, which he would just start writing out solutions, and he would write like 100 solutions. And then once he got to the end of the list, he'd find like one that worked. Yeah, I think writer's block is like trauma. And I think everything's like trauma these days. And if you acknowledge it, you can work with it. If you don't acknowledge it, it's going to work you over. I don't know. What do you do about writer's block?
I think it's similar. I think movement and taking and stepping away. I think perspective shift or task switching is pretty good. You know, and I'm like you. I share similar feelings about it. You know, I like what Seth Godin says. You know, he doesn't get writer's block because he writes like he talks, and he doesn't get talker's block. Right? I think that's an interesting idea, but really, in truth, you know, writing is a very specific set of tasks that your brain does, and training your brain to do them is something that we learn early on in our lives. But then it seems to get, for some reason, even, you know, bestselling authors like yourself, I've heard this over and over and over again. Each book is similarly hard. It's not like you're getting, you know, like it's getting easier and easier and easier to sit down and do this thing that's really, really taxing on your brain, I think.
I think it's harder for me. I mean, if you look at my tendency in terms of publishing, and not everybody is this way. Some people go the opposite direction, but it gets harder for me and it takes longer each time. So in 2012, I published 2 books. In 2013, and so I published a book at the beginning of 2012. 6 months later, I published another book. So 6 months in between, right? Next year, exactly a year later, I published another book. So now we've got a year in between. About 6 months in between the books, now we have a year in between. Then I published a book in 2015. Now we've got 2 years apart. Then I published a book in 2017. So we kind of kept that 2-year trajectory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been 4 years since then.
Interesting.
It feels like it gets harder because my expectations get higher of what I think I'm capable of. Mm. Because by the end of a book, you are a different person. And the way that you would do it would be completely different. This is why it's actually a really good idea to have an editor or a publisher or someone other than you who says, okay, it's time to publish this book. Because the really frustrating part about writing a book, if you take significant time to write it, which every author does, even if you're writing a book in 30 days, that's a significant amount of time. By the time you get to the end of the book, you are a different person with different lived experiences, and you're thinking about this topic from page 1 to page 200 or whatever has probably shifted a little bit.
Yeah.
And I find that I could just keep rewriting the book over and over and over again. You know, I get to the end of the book, I immediately want to go back and rewrite it. And there's value in that. That's editing, revisioning. And every time I get to the end of the book, I want to go back and write it again because I've learned, I've grown, I've changed.
Uh-huh.
And so you've got to have somebody who's not crazy, because you're crazy when you're working on a creative project, to say, okay, we're done. Let's let this go. Let's let it be what it is, and let's go do something else.
Yeah. Interesting. I think, well, yeah, you're absolutely spot on with the, you can, you know, you probably start each, especially like in a nonfiction genre, you start each with a thesis and your thesis changes. And I think some fictionists come at it with the idea that they don't know what the book is about until they've gotten to, you know, close to the end of writing it. And then they realize that this is what the book's about. Then they have to smooth, you know, go back and smooth it to get it to, you know, polish it or whittle it to where it actually needed to go.
Yeah. I feel the same about nonfiction books. Actually, I have an idea. It's like the scientific method. I have an hypothesis for what I think this thing is about. And then when I get into it, I figure out what it's about.
You solve the
the question, the problem, yeah. Which is, yeah, I never really know what I'm doing. And the reason that I'm making things is to figure out what it is I'm trying to make. And I envy the people who know what they're making ahead of time, because I never do.
But that seems kind of boring. Well, let's turn the clock back a little bit and talk a little, some about your background as a writer, or just maybe the impetus to becoming a writer. I read some interviews and I love this quote where you describe imagination as the strongest, most powerful human capability. And yeah, that, talk a little bit about why you became a writer and the importance of storytellers just right now in the world.
You know, in my books, very often the main characters, the women in my book, are very frustrated by life, because they discover as they become adults that life is just life, that life is nothing like the movies or the big novels that you read. And I think I was like that when I was a teenager. I was reading a lot of books. I was a crazy reader. And, you know, when I was reading, I could think only about that, about the book I was reading. And I wanted to live in the book and to be the character and to dress like her and to eat like her. And I was afraid to have a life that would be a very common life, and to get annoyed and to do every day the same thing. And I wanted a life that was bigger than life, something huge. I wanted to travel everywhere, to know everyone, to experience every passion. And I understood that if I wanted to do that, I needed to be a writer, because when you're a writer, you can do all that. And freedom makes you free. Freedom makes it possible to travel in time, to travel in anywhere in the world. You can be a man, a woman, a ghost, a chair. You can be whatever you want to be. And it's just extraordinary. And you can say whatever you want to say. You don't have to be polite. You don't have to please people. You don't have to, you can say whatever you want to say. And it's a work of sincerity and of truth. And I love that.
Mm, yeah. Let's talk about your creative process and this undertaking of the trilogy. I would assume that you're in the throes of working on the second part.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm almost finished. I have one scene left. And my process, I would love to tell you that I have a real process and that I have a structure and that I know what I do, but I absolutely don't know what I do. And my publisher, he always told me, I don't understand how you write book. I understand nothing to your process. My process is drinking coffee, smoking a lot of cigarettes, writing, hiding myself in my office to watch TV shows on Netflix when I have no inspiration. It's not glamorous at all, really, believe me. And I make naps on my desk when I'm too tired and I have no inspiration. And at the end of the day, I feel very guilty because I haven't worked enough and I'm sure that I'm going to have cancer because of the cigarettes. So I drink. So that's really messy, the truth.
The truth is stranger than fiction, but yes, it's messy and ordinary. And it sounds like so many writers I know are writers that have come on this show. But yeah, talk a little bit about I don't know, maybe it's, you know, we talk a lot about the imposter syndrome with famous writers, and you know, you've accomplished quite a bit of acclaim, and you know, now that you're kind of looking back on your career, do you still feel some of that, as you put it, kind of the imposter syndrome with, you know, you've reached this pinnacle and now what's she going to do? You know, like talk a little bit about that, maybe the feeling of with each new novel.
You know, I think that a writer should never be famous. And I think that success is very dangerous for a writer. A few weeks ago, I was writing the diary of John Steinbeck, the diary he was writing while writing, I don't know how to say in English, The Grapes of Wrath.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's astonishing because he said he has a certain kind of regret of being famous. And it's the same for Hemingway or Fitzgerald. I think it's always very difficult because you feel that success is very unfair. Why this book works and why another book that you like very much has absolutely no success. So I think it's very important to distance yourself from the commentators, from the way media are treating you. And it's the most important thing when you are a writer is trying to keep your honesty. You have to do everything you can to be honest. And when you have success, when you have people calling you and photo shoots and all that, sometimes you're afraid to lose this honesty and this sincerity. And you're afraid that your heart and your soul is going to be poisoned with that. So yeah, I try to do my best and to do everything I can to prevent me from being poisoned by success. And so sometimes when I have bad critics or when people can be violent on the social media, it's going to seem weird to you, but I feel a kind of relief. And I'm like, okay, that's good. Come against me because I need that also. I don't want you to, I'm afraid by this idea of success because I think, yeah, that it can really have a bad influence on your work. So you really need to build a bubble, a fortress in which you live and not thinking about what's happening outside.
Yeah, that must be tough. And that fortress you talk about. So you find that getting bad reviews is kind of refreshing.
Sometimes, yeah. You know, I know a lot of writers who tell me, oh, I never read reviews, but I know that it's true. It's not true. It's a lie. Of course, we all read the reviews. And you have also to accept to have bad reviews and to try to be better and try to improve yourself. And I don't like the idea that, you know, I have a writer say, oh, I had a bad review, but this man is stupid. Why did he say that about me? I'm like, no, maybe what he says is interesting and maybe it can help you to be a better writer. I think you should always try to find a way to improve yourself, and you have to read and accept everything that people say. If you accept the compliments, I don't know why you wouldn't accept bad reviews. Of course, if you accept the idea that they say it's great, but you don't accept when they say it's not great, no.
Yeah, that's important. So, okay, before we wrap up here with your advice to your fellow scribes and just how to stay, how to keep going and how to survive the tough times, a fun question for you. If you could have dinner with any author from any era at your favorite restaurant in the world, all expenses paid, who would you take and where would you take them?
Tolstoy, Chekhov, and Virginia Woolf. And we would probably go somewhere in Russia, in the countryside. I would ask Chekhov for an advice, and I think he would find a very nice restaurant for the four of us.
Of course.
And we would have a lot of vodka, of course.
lots of good potato vodka.
Yeah.
Perhaps, yeah. Of course, Chekhov would have the line on the best spot in Russia. Fantastic. All right. The latest is In the Country of Others. It is the first installment of a planned trilogy of which you are in the throes. And we really do appreciate your time. I thought the New York Times and the book review had some very nice things to say about it, that you've made a career out of catching readers on the wrong foot with unsparing prose. And In the Country of Others lays bare women's intimate, lacerating experience of war and its consequent trauma. Congrats on the work. So yeah, your final advice just for fellow writers on just how to keep going through the tough times.
Drink good red wine. There's nothing better for inspiration. Good French red wine, a good Bordeaux, and everything will be okay.
Perfect. A good Bordeaux. Well, we appreciate your time and best of luck with the rest of the tour. And we look forward to reading more of you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Writer Files. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review to help other writers out there find us. You can always leave a comment or a question and visit the entire archives at writerfiles.fm. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.